In 1965, 13-year-old Mary Beth Tinker showed up at her Des Moines school with a black armband to protest the Vietnam War. Little did she know that act would lead to a historic U.S. Supreme Court decision. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Iowa Week on our talk shows. Instead of our usual Politics Wednesday, we're focusing on legal milestones and activists in our state's history, in addition to talking with Mary Beth Tinker about that historic U.S. Supreme Court case. We'll hear the story of Iowan Arabella Mansfield, the first female lawyer in the United States, and about several other fascinating and historic Iowa court cases. That's all coming up this hour, right after a look at the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Iowa Week on our talk shows. This week, we're taking a break from our usual Wednesday Politics Day to look at some legal milestones, also activists in our state's history. The U.S. Supreme Court decision Tinker v. Des Moines Independent Community School District is a milestone not only in Iowa legal history, but in the history of our country. It defined the constitutional rights of students in U.S. public schools. And to explain it, we have to go back to 1965, to the early days of the Vietnam War. And in that year, the death toll for U.S. soldiers in Vietnam had climbed to over 1,000. In December, a 13-year-old named Mary Beth Tinker was an eighth grader at Warren Harding Junior High School in Des Moines. Now, Mary Beth, along with her 15-year-old brother John and their 16-year-old friend Chris Eckhart, decided to wear black armbands. This was to mourn the dead in the Vietnam conflict and to support a Christmas truce. The Tinkers and Eckhart were suspended for wearing those black armbands, but with the aid of the ACLU, they sued the Des Moines Independent School District. It's a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court, where 4 years later, in 1969, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Tinker's favor 7-2. The court ruled that since wearing black armbands did not interfere with the educational process, the First Amendment allowed the Tinkers and Eckhart to protest the war in this fashion and that they should not have been suspended. Today, Mary Beth Tinker is a pediatric nurse. She advocates also for civics education, and currently she's traveling the country on the Tinker Tour along with First Amendment attorney Mike Heaston. Mary Beth and Mike are visiting 18 states and the District of Columbia, talking to students about the importance of youth voices, and also free speech and free press. On November 19th, the Tinker Tour will stop at North High School in Des Moines. Mary Beth Tinker joins us now. Good afternoon to you, Mary Beth.
Good afternoon, Ben. It's so good to be with you today, and thank you for inviting me on the program.
What a pleasure to have you, and an honor to have an historic figure on our program today. Where are you now, may I ask, on this tour?
I'm sitting in one of the classrooms with a journalism instructor at South Hadley High School, where we had a very good morning this morning, talking with students about the Constitution, the First Amendment, all of the things that they want to stand up for and speak up about today. So it's a very good morning here in Massachusetts, and I'm so excited to be heading now north and then eventually west towards Iowa. Can't wait to get back to see my fellow Iowans again.
We'll look forward to that. Now tell us a little bit about this story from your perspective. How did you and your brother and Chris Eckhart come up with the idea of wearing black armbands?
It was really a group project because I was raised in the church. My father was a Methodist minister, and he was in Atlantic, Iowa first, and then we moved to Des Moines when I was about 5 years old. But my father and also my mother believed that they should put their Christian values into action here on earth and not wait for heaven. So they started getting involved with some, you know, things that they saw right in their own neighborhood, in their own town, starting in Atlantic, Iowa. There was, I guess, an issue with the swimming pool there. This is in the late 50s, where a lot, and this happened a lot around the country, where the swimming pool would be whites only, or there would be a policy like that. And so my father stood up about that, and he went to the city hall, and he started speaking up when I was even a very young child, and that's the way that I was raised. And then when we went to Des Moines, he continued to do that, and my mother as well. He was a very conservative, and in a way, he was conservative socially, and he, mm-hmm. you know, wasn't a rabble rouser or anything, but he just believed in these values of Christianity, like love and brotherhood, and also in democratic values of equality. And so that's the way that we were raised.
Now, when did Vietnam enter your awareness? Because 1965, when you went to school with these black armbands, it was still early days in what turned out to be a quagmire.
Well, in the early 60s, my father went to work for the Quakers, for the American Friends Service Committee, in about 1962. And so that's part of his job there was to be the peace education director, and he had a five-state area there. And so a lot of our discussions were about peace, and we were going to Quaker meeting, and of course the Quakers are all about peace through history and are generally pacifists. So a lot of our discussions at home were about peace, and we started learning more about Vietnam. I mean, I was a child. I was very young. I didn't really understand all of it and all of the politics and things, but I would just see these images on television also that were very upsetting, the huts burning on fire and the body bags and the body count every night on the news, where Walter Cronkite was, you know, giving these counts, and all of that was very upsetting to us as children, which I think war is always upsetting to children, and so that was our experience of it.
Tell us about that day and what happened when you showed up in school at Warren Harding Junior High School in Des Moines with black armbands, and were there just three of you?
Well, I was the only one at Harding, and then it was a group project, as I said. Some students had decided at Roosevelt High School, and then my brother John at North High School, to wear armbands in support of a Christmas truce that was being proposed by Robert Kennedy, the senator. It was right at Christmas time, and so, of course, we thought that was a good idea because Christmas is all about love and peace, and so, of course, we supported this idea of the truce. It seemed very reasonable to us kids, but there were other students over at the high school, Ross Peterson, Bruce Clark, Chris Singer, Terry Hutchison, a group of, students in Des Moines, but really just a handful, as Thurgood Marshall later pointed out in the Supreme Court arguments, that it was really just a handful of students in a school district of 18,000. Mm-hmm. Who were wearing the armbands.
So you came into class that day. Tell us what happened.
Well, I was scared, and I was in eighth grade, and I was very nervous. And even though I was surrounded by strong, brave people like my parents who stood up for what they believed in, I wasn't really like that. I mean, I was just a kind of an ordinary girl, but I decided to do it. I think having the older kids involved was really part of the encouragement of it. Although my little brother and sister, Hope and Paul, they even wore armbands too. That day, one was in fifth grade and one in second, and they said, you know, we want peace, too. And so I was nervous, and I went to school with my friend Connie, like I always did, and then when I got there, the morning was fine. There wasn't much problem in the classes. Some kids were warning me that I was going to get in trouble, because what happened was 2 days before we were supposed to wear the armbands, the principals heard about the plan and made a rule against armbands. Mm. So that was a big dilemma because I wasn't a person to break the rules. But yet I felt that kids should have rights too, you know, that we should be able to express ourselves too. And I was so, really, it came from the heart. It was an emotional response about the war.
So you're in class, I believe, algebra class, and you're actually pulled out of class, aren't you?
Yeah, when I got to Mr. Moberly's class after lunch, he was waiting there at the door with a pink slip to go to the office, for me to go to the office, which I did. And I went there, and I saw the girl's advisor, Miss Tarman, and she was always very nice, and she just told me there was a rule against armbands, and I have to take off the armband, which I did, and I went back to class, but then I was suspended anyway.
Really?
Yeah.
And, even though you did what they requested, you took off the armband, you didn't put it back on.
Exactly. And that's my message partly to young people, is that if you're afraid to stand up for something that you believe and you're scared, you know, just use the little bit of courage that you might have, because you could be amazed at what a difference it might make.
Did that shake you quite a bit? Imagine it would have.
Yes, it did. It was very strange. But, you know, when I came home, it probably would have been the end of the whole thing. And I kind of thought it probably would be the end of the whole thing, because we just thought it was such a small little thing that we had done. But we started getting all of these threatening letters, and people threw red paint at our house, and people threatened to...
These are residents of Des Moines.
Yes, in Des Moines. And people called us on Christmas Eve and threatened to bomb our house. We got these hate postcards saying that we were traitors. And, oh, I have one letter saying that, you know, just the thought of us was enough to make them sick, you know. And then after Christmas vacation, we went back to school without the armbands. And then a woman called as I was on my way out the door. And she said, "Is this Mary Beth Tinker?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "I'm going to kill you." And I think that was the first time in my life that it really hit home to me that there are these kind of dangerous people out there that really don't understand what you're saying and really don't care. Because we were just kids who were upset about war. That was our whole message. So we got positive reactions, too. People would say that it was good that we stood up for peace and that we were speaking up for ourselves. And one of the groups that did was the local chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, as you said, the Iowa Civil Liberties Union. Mm-hmm. They came in and talked to my parents about what we could do. And
Mary Beth Tinker is with us today as a 13-year-old, eighth grader at Warren Harding Junior High School in Des Moines. She was suspended for wearing a black armband. With the aid of the ACLU, sued the Des Moines Independent School District. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where 4 years later, 1969, the court ruled in Tinker's favor 7-2. And it's really been something that has defined the constitutional rights of students in U.S. public schools. And she's on tour talking about that right now and fits so well in with Iowa Week. So the ACLU comes on board. This case gets argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. In all that intervening time, you were a celebrity, or I guess notorious,
not at all. That was, I mean, we just went on with our lives. My brother John had been suspended the day after I was, and Chris Eckhart and these other students. Several of the students, their parents chose not to, you know, pursue it in our court case. So there were the three of us plaintiffs that went ahead with it, and life went on, you know, pretty normally, I'd say. Well, the war kept building up. That was the upsetting part about our lives, I'd say. And then there was also so much upheaval.
So 4 years later, the Supreme Court makes this decision. Do you remember the moment when you heard that ruling come down?
Yes, I do. We had moved to St. Louis, and I was sitting in the living room with my sister Hope and my brother Paul and our mother. I think my father was out of town. He was at the Paris Peace Talks at that time. And so I just found a letter that my mother wrote to my father. Actually, I found it recently, and she said, "Oh, honey, we won the case. It's so wonderful." And I celebrated by going out and getting some ice cream and soda pop for the kids, and we had a nice celebration about the case.
Did you realize when that decision came down that it would be such a milestone?
No, I had absolutely no idea about it. When it first hit me very much was when I found that the case was in my nursing school textbook. I was studying for an exam, and there I see my name, and they talked about this case in terms of children's rights. And I've come to realize, well, I've worked with children, as you said, as a nurse for many years, and I've come to see our case in the context of children's rights and the larger issue of human rights, really, that young people should have a voice and should have a say about the decisions that affect their lives.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more about the Tinker Tour that you're on. You're visiting 18 states and the District of Columbia over the next few weeks. On November 19th, you'll be stopping at North High School in Des Moines. So what are you trying to do on this tour?
I am encouraging young people to use their voices, because when they speak up, their voices are very powerful and they can make a difference. They can help our world go to a better place. We have so many issues, and we have a crisis in our country and our world now. We have climate problems. We have war, and we have a lot of violence in our communities, and our schools don't have enough priority in our society. There are so many budget cuts. I talked to so many kids they've lost guidance counselors. Even here at South Hadley, they were talking about the teachers that have been lost just from last year to this year. So it's a time when young people's voices are needed, and they are very creative and energetic, and they can make a difference, but they need rights to do that.
What do you hear from the students you've been talking with? When you tell them your story, what kind of interesting reactions have you received?
Young people really like to hear about the Constitution applying to them also, because they want to be part of things. They want to feel like they're part of the society too. So they get excited to think about the idea that, yes, young people have helped to build our country all through history. And they've worked in the factories. They've worked in the, farms. They've even fought in wars. So my message is that young people have always been involved in building our country, and they are today. Again, I want to encourage them and let them know, yes, you are part of our democracy, and we need your youth and your energy and your great ideas. And I just want to encourage them to keep speaking up.
The 60s, of course, we associate with political activism, the civil rights movement, the conflict, the war in Vietnam, all of the heated arguments and tumult that belonged to that time. Do you think that we in any way match or can match that degree of activism in this era with young people? Or has this generation, I guess the me generation, lost that feeling?
No, I think that there are so many kids are speaking up right now. And that's what I want to, tell people about and share those stories. There are young people all over the country that are speaking up against public school closings and budget cut closings, and these are kids of all ages, and they're just standing up about so many different things.
Your old school, the one you attended in 1965 when you were suspended, it's now called Harding Middle School, I understand.
Yeah.
They have retired your locker. What does that mean, to retire a locker?
Well, I'm so excited that we're going to be going to Harding on our Tinker Tour, and I'm going to be speaking with students there, and then we're also going to North High School in the morning, where my brother John was suspended, and then Harding in the afternoon. And we've come back to Des Moines before, and we've had a warm welcome. And I saw Mr. Moberly there before, and we gave each other a hug, and I asked him if he would still send me to the office.
What did he say?
He said, well, I would have to, I guess, if it was still against the rules.
Now. What about your locker has been retired? Well, does it get turned? Is it turned into some kind of memorial?
I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen. I guess that'll be a surprise. I have heard, talk that they're going to be dedicating the locker to the Mary Beth Tinker locker, but I'm not sure. All I know is I'm excited to go back to the place where I had so many good experiences and where I really enjoyed a good period of my life with friends and some really great teachers as well. In fact, Mr. Morley was one of my favorite teachers, and I think he was responsible.
He may
for
be
me
listening right now.
So
well,
much.
Mary Beth Tinker, we are excited to have spoken with you, and are excited to welcome you here to Iowa on the Tinker Tour on November 19th. You'll be at North High School in Des Moines. Any other places you want to mention that you'll be that we should get out?
Oh, we're going to Detroit. We're going to the Birmingham Civil Rights Center. We're going to Indiana. We're going to Texas. We're going to Florida. We're just going all over on the fall portion of our tour.
Mary Beth Tinker, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today. Here's to the Constitution.
Here's to the Constitution. So glad to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Iowa Week on our talk shows, exploring individuals and events that shaped our state in a variety of fields. And today, here on River to River, we're focusing the hour on historic legal cases and individuals in law. And here's some important Iowa trivia you may not know about. I sure didn't. Iowa has the distinction of having been home to the first female lawyer in the United States. Her name, Arabella Mansfield. She was born Belle Aurelia Babb, and she was admitted to the Iowa bar in the year 1869. That made her the first woman allowed to practice law in the United States. Joining me now to tell us a little bit more about this historic figure, Judge Emily Gould Chafa. She's an administrative law judge for the state of Iowa and the past president of the Iowa Organization for Women Attorneys. This organization, the IOWA, presents the Arabella Mansfield Award every year. It's an award that recognizes outstanding women lawyers in Iowa who have promoted and nurtured women in the legal profession. Judge Gould Chafa, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell me, let's start off with a little bit about her early life. She had her father died when she was very young, 5 or 6 years old. How did that affect her?
Her father ventured out to California in 1850, as you said, when she was very young, to work in the mines. He died in 1852 in a California mine tunnel cave-in. Soon thereafter, and this is something I think is very significant, Arabella's mother secured a scholarship for her and her brother at Iowa Wesleyan College. And when asked why she did that for such a young child, especially a woman at that time, her mother said, "I realized the potential precariousness of total reliance on a husband." Isn't that an amazing thing for a mother to say and at that time in, you know, the 1850s?
Oh, well, it certainly does sound like a provocative thing to say. Before she went to Iowa Wesleyan College, she tell us a little bit more about what sort of community Mount Pleasant, Iowa was when she grew up in the 1850s and 60s.
Mount Pleasant was a hotbed of revolutionary thought. It was a stop on the Underground Railroad. It was populated with abolitionists, women suffrage activists. It was the home of Howe's Academy, a co-ed seminary, an educational institution, which was unusual at the time. It was also the home of Iowa Wesleyan College, mm-hmm. where Belle Babb Mansfield attended college. It seemed to be quite a progressive community for the time.
Tell us how she came to be the first woman to be admitted to practice law in the U.S.
At the time, lawyers did not necessarily attend law school like we do now for 3 years and then take an organized class to study for the bar exam and then take the bar exam. They studied or read the law for a certain period of time mm-hmm. and then took the bar exam. So that's what she did. She began studying law in 1867 in her brother's law office in Mount Pleasant. She was married in 1868 to John Mansfield, and the two of them took the bar exam together.
Now, after being admitted to the Iowa bar, did she practice law after taking that and passing it?
It doesn't appear that she did. She entered academia and taught again at Iowa Wesleyan College and then at DePauw University in Indiana. But as far as any of us can tell, she didn't ever actually actively practice law, mm-hmm. as unusual as that may seem.
Thank you very much for telling us about Iowa history and about this historic figure from Iowa, Arabella Mansfield, the first woman allowed to practice law in the United States. Thank you, Judge Emily Gould Chafa.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, Iowa Week continues here on River to River. We'll find out about Iowa's unique nonpartisan redistricting process and about several other fascinating and historic Iowa court cases. We'll hear about the very first case decided by the Iowa Supreme Court. It concerned a bounty hunter who went after a former slave in Iowa. And a couple of interesting tort cases. Guy Cook will be along to tell us about those. One involving a booby-trapped shotgun on an abandoned property. You want to stay tuned. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And if you've been listening and enjoying, we're enjoying it. It's Iowa Week on our talk shows this week. Today, instead of our usual politics day, we're looking at legal milestones, activists in our state's history, aspects in this area that make Iowa unique. And here's a political trait of Iowa that sets it apart from other states in a very important way. After every census, states redraw their congressional and legislative districts. And this happened to Iowa recently. We lost a congressional seat because our population didn't grow as fast as other parts of the country. So now we have 4 congressional seats instead of 5 and completely new district boundaries. In almost all states, it's the legislators who draw the new maps, and they work the system to create safe seats for themselves and their colleagues. They also try to preserve or extend their party's power, but not in Iowa. Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, joins us briefly to explain. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ben.
So how does Iowa redraw its districts when necessary?
Well, you're absolutely right. It is unique. Iowa, unlike every other state, has a nonpartisan process. This is a process that goes through the Legislative Services Agency in Des Moines. They have the option to draw up the plan. The plan goes to the state legislature. The state legislature then votes on the plan with no amendments. They just vote it up or down. They can do that on the first 2 plans, and then if they get to a 3rd plan, they can amend it, but then with very limited power, and then it's adopted. And this has been the case for Iowa since 1981.
It seems we love our incumbents just as much as other states do, so does it really matter?
Well, I think it does. I think what's interesting is if you look back over time, if you separate when this initially went into effect by the Iowa Supreme Court in 1972, before the Legislative Services Agency got involved, prior to that time, we saw a lot of fluctuation in elections where you would have 70% of the elections from 1900 to 1972, you saw big changes. After that time, we've seen much more moderation where we have very small changes in the seats, and we have a very competitive state legislative assembly where you see very small changes in seats over time.
Outside of Iowa, people looking at our system, since it is unique, is Iowa viewed as somewhat as a model?
It is. Because Iowa puts such an emphasis on these population requirements, the Legislative Services Agency has to draw these districts in such a way that the populations can really deviate by no more than about 1% between all the districts. And Iowa is looked at. There is one other state, California, that is trying to move in this direction. They actually have a citizen panel that will draw up the districts, but Iowa and California are really the only ones so far that have been able to introduce a nonpartisan process. And part of it comes from the fact that it's hard to get there. It took 20 years, really, for this process to get started in Iowa. It started in the 1950s, where you had rural and urban legislators battling it out for representation in the legislature, and it wasn't until 1972 when it was actually resolved.
So I'm seeing how, even though we're a model, could be a model for other states, it's hard to get there because you have entrenched legislators gerrymandering, having a hand in gerrymandering districts into all sorts of bizarre-looking districts so that they or their colleagues are safe. So there's really not a path to the rest of the country being more like Iowa in this way, is there?
No, there really isn't. And like I said, you know, we always hear about the rural versus urban interests in Iowa. This is the rural versus urban issue in Iowa. And as Iowa became more urban in the 1950s, you saw a push to make that more balanced in the Iowa legislature with more urban interests. But that was really hard to get to. It took 20 years. It took battles between the Democrats and Republicans. It took Iowa Supreme Court intervention on a number of cases to finally get to this point where we have this nonpartisan process. So it wasn't easy.
We live in a very hyper-partisan atmosphere, have for many years on a national level, unwillingness to seek common ground. Help us imagine how our national politics might be different if every state did redistricting in Iowa's nonpartisan fashion. Would it help in that regard?
Well, I think you would see more competition. I think you might see more moderate stances on certain issues. You would definitely see more competition. You may see it's a little early to tell, but you may see the term of incumbents maybe not as long. And so I think it would change not only the election campaigns, I think it would change policy stances perhaps, and it would certainly change who decides to run for office. Because, I mean, when you change the district, that is really fundamental to elections.
But it doesn't look like on the national scene, they're going in this direction.
Not at all. Not at all.
Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNI, thank you for cluing us in on this.
Sure. Happy to be here.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And as we near the end of our hour, we turn our attention to talk about an important civil rights case that's linked to Iowa for this Iowa Week. Joining me now, Michael Cates, Executive Director of the African American Museum of Iowa in Cedar Rapids in our Iowa City studio. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This is an interesting case that have you tell us a little bit about. It happens to be the very first case decided by the Iowa Supreme Court way back in 1839. The case goes by the name The Matter of Ralph and concerns a man named Ralph Montgomery. Tell us that story.
Yeah. Well, Ralph was born in roughly about 1795, and his name was originally Ralph Nelson, and he was named after his slave owner. And interesting enough, his slave owner was having some financial problems, and so he sold Ralph to his brother, and in turn, Ralph sold him to Jordan, his son, for roughly about $820.
And this is taking place where? Not in Iowa, though.
No, this is taking place in roughly about the territory of Virginia at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what happens then?
And then, you know, Jordan is, again, having financial problems, and so he wants to figure out a way that he can shore up some of his financial problems, and he decides that he was going to give Ralph a note of freedom. And so him and Ralph agreed that they will pay, I think it was a sum of about $500 for Ralph's freedom, and there would be roughly about $50 for any work that he's doing. And so what it begins to happen is Ralph decides that he was going to travel up, and I should go back and say they had moved to Missouri, the Missouri area.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ralph goes up into the Dubuque area to work in the mines. And this is, of course, with the blessing of the of his slave owner to work in the – yeah.
So he buys his freedom for about $500. The slave owner needs that money, and then he moves from Missouri, which is a slave state, into up to Iowa, which is then a free state, right?
That's correct. And keep in mind, it was a note. He was basically agreed to pay off he would pay for his freedom.
Right. Nothing legal. Just an agreement
between two men. So he works in the mines, and he doesn't do very well. He's only able to pay for his clothing. He's only able to pay for food. And during that period of time, Jordan, who's the slave owner, he begins to suffer some financial hardship. They get into some different ventures, and they're not able to shore up the money. So he decides, hey, you know what? I need to bring Ralph back. And so he actually hires some Virginia slave raiders to come up to Iowa and to find Ralph. And they do indeed find him. They lay hands on him, so to speak, and they decide that they're going to bring him back. And interesting enough, while they were doing this, there was a gentleman that had worked with Ralph in the mines. And this gentleman said, hey, you know what, this is wrong. And so he went to the judge, and there was a prominent judge. And he said to the judge, hey, you know what, this should not be happening. And so the judge issued habeas corpus, and that's basically where you'd have to go before the judge in any court case. And he went before the judge, and basically the judge decides that they should hear this trial. And the Iowa Supreme Court hears the trial, and they basically decide that Ralph should indeed go free. Now, the defense, and this is the defense's claim was, considering that Ralph had never paid his debt,
right,
then he was still indebted to the slave owner, and therefore he should go back. And there was also a claim that Iowa was never considered an official a free state. And so that was their claim. And Ralph's defense claimed simply this: under the Missouri Compromise, the Missouri Territory, Iowa was considered a non-slave state. And of course, that he also claimed that as soon as Ralph stepped into the territory of Iowa, then he should have, in fact, been free.
And when we talk about this sum, if it was $500 or $550, back in 1839, I can scarcely imagine what that would be worth in today's dollars. It would be probably tens of thousands of dollars if we think about paying for your own freedom. So working in a mine is not going to give you a lot of money left over. So this goes to the Iowa Supreme Court, and they decide what?
They decide that, hey, you know what, just because he was in this territory and he had the debt did not necessarily make him a fugitive slave. They basically said, hey, as soon as he entered into Iowa territory, he was indeed free. And so they set him free. Matter of fact, they said he should be freed immediately. And again, one of the prominent people that I want to point out is Judge Thomas Wilson. And he was the person, the judge that Ralph went before for habeas corpus. And the other person that really was really instrumental was that friend and that he worked in the mines with, and that was Mr. Buttlesworth.
Mm-hmm. And this is interesting. It shows Iowa in a very good light at this time in our history, especially when we look at a very famous U.S. Supreme Court case, the Dred Scott case. Dred Scott, a slave who had lived in the free state of Illinois, he unsuccessfully sued for his freedom and that of his wife and their two daughters in the Dred Scott v. Sanford case of 1857, the Dred Scott decision. So that went against Dred Scott in that case, in a sort of a similar case, didn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, keep in mind that this was also, during that case, the conclusion was black people were not considered citizens. As you see with the Ralph case, you know, Iowa's making a definitive conclusion that, indeed, African Americans are citizens and they're going to be citizens of the state. So, you know, if you think about, you know, the progression of what Iowa's done. Now, I don't want to state that Iowa has never had any problems in regard to black codes and different things that went on. And there was even some on the books where Iowa simply said blacks couldn't live in certain places. But in regard to just this decision, very early on in Iowa history, they emphatically said African Americans were indeed free people if they came to this state, unlike the Dred Scott case where African Americans were considered non-Americans.
Okay, thank you very much. Michael Cates, Executive Director of the African American Museum of Iowa in Cedar Rapids. We want to mention tomorrow night your museum is holding a 2013 History Makers Gala from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Hotel Kirkwood in Cedar Rapids. And for more information, go to the African American Museum's website. Michael, thank you very much for stopping in.
All right, thank you.
And we finish up today. Well, we're not going to leave the courtroom. We're going to stay in the courtroom, but shift our focus to talk about a couple of important but largely forgotten Iowa Supreme Court tort law cases. Guy Cook is joining us in Des Moines in our studio there. Hi, Guy.
Good afternoon, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back on the program. Guy Cook, certified trial lawyer for Grief and Sidney in Des Moines, president of the Iowa State Bar Association, also full disclosure and underwriter for Iowa Public Radio. Quickly tell us, we want to get through a couple cases here in less than 10 minutes. Tell us, for those of us who don't know, or remind us, what is tort law? What is it?
Well, tort law, it's one of the few areas I remember my Latin. It's a civil wrong ex delicto et non contracto. But what it really means—
Okay, that explains it.
Yeah, what it really means is this. A tort is a civil wrong in which one party, called the plaintiff, who is damaged by a negligent act or an intentional act, another person, the defendant, can seek redress, normally in the form of money damages.
Okay. Let's talk about a couple of cases. 1971, a case, is it Katko v. Briney?
Briney, Katko versus Briney. It's a 1971 case. It's a famous tort case that's used in textbooks across the country in law school that deals with the duties to trespassers and the right to protect your property.
This one's almost like it's right out of reality television, isn't it?
The facts are pretty remarkable, and they would make a good show or a movie, I think. It's about a 40-year-old case decided by the Supreme Court Justice C. Edwin Moore, writing for the majority. And it involves Edward Briney, who set up a spring-loaded shotgun in sort of a trapping arrangement in an abandoned farmhouse on his property to deter intruders.
Mm-hmm. And he'd had break-ins, weeks of break-ins, right? So trespassing, damage to his property. He didn't do that just out of the blue, right?
Right. He'd had a series of trespasses and entries which caused a loss of household goods and disarray. And so he'd complained to the sheriff with no relief. He'd put up trespass signs, no trespass, no relief. And so he finally decided to set up this shotgun that he thought would deter intruders on this abandoned farmhouse. We've all seen them. No one lives there. The outbuildings are dilapidated, but there were still some household items in the house, and so he puts up this trap gun in one of the bedrooms in the house. And Mr. Katko and one of his friends, Mr. Katko lived near Eddyville. This was in Mahaska County. They're sort of exploring these abandoned houses and looking for old bottles and dated fruit jars and those kinds of things. They had been to the house one at a time and had actually garnered a few items, and they returned about a month later, and they'd opened a plank over one of the windows and climbed in, and his companion was in the kitchen digging around, and Mr. Katko wandered into the remainder of the house. And that's where it gets interesting. He came upon a door in one of the bedrooms. He removed a chair that braced the door and began to pull the door toward him, and then boom.
Wow.
A shotgun went off and struck him in the right leg just above the ankle.
Mm, okay, and there was a court case about this. We want to move on to the other case, too. But what was the decision of the court, and what do people who study law about it take from it today?
Right, a couple things. The court ruled that deadly force on intruders in an unoccupied property was not reasonable or justified. It would have been different had there been someone living at the home at the time. And so it talks about the duty to trespassers, and the landowner has no duty to make his property safe for trespassers, but he cannot engage in willful or wanton type conduct like setting up this this trap.
Okay, so no booby traps. That's something
No booby traps. And,
okay.
And I guess it strikes people, I think, maybe as a little counterintuitive, but at the end of the day, the rule is this. Our society values life over property.
Okay, that's a good rule to remember. One more case we want in this tort area of law. Gutzman and Wishern?
Yeah, the Gutzman case is really important, and people, I think, have forgotten about it. It was decided in 1982. We now have a system in Iowa called comparative fault, where let's say you're involved in a car crash, an intersection. In the old days, before this case, if you had any fault at all in that car crash, let's say 1%, and the defendant proved that you as the plaintiff had some fault, no matter how much, you were barred from any recovery. It was called contributory negligence. It was part of the common law. And people found that to be unfair in that you could have genuine injuries caused by someone else, yet if you had any fault yourself, you were excluded from recovery 100%. So the law was challenged many times. Finally, this case came before the Supreme Court, decided, as I mentioned, in 1982. It involved a medical malpractice action against a doctor. And Mary Getzman had been treated for a diagnosis of breast cancer over a period of time, and she alleged that the doctor failed to properly diagnose her, and she had to have a mastectomy to deal with this and other damages. Right before the trial, the doctor's lawyer said, you know what, we think maybe she was negligent. We think maybe she didn't follow the doctor's orders, didn't do some of the things that the doctor told her to do. And the case went to trial, and the jury found for the defendant, finding that there must have been some negligence on the part of Ms. Getzman. Her lawyers, interestingly, one of them, a fellow named David S. Wiggins, now a justice on the Iowa Supreme Court.
Of course, yeah.
Pursued this case, and the Supreme Court said that now was the time to change the law, that we should make these situations fair, and we should not prohibit folks from making a claim because there might be some alleged assertion of contributory negligence that would bar their claim entirely. It's really built upon making the system fairer and allowing people to recover damages caused by someone else's fault.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about this sort of tort law, these sorts of precedents that are set here in the state, is that something that each state then decides for itself in the case here of contributory negligence?
Well, that's another thing that the case stands for, and that is the notion of common law. Many lay people will say, well, the court doesn't make law. Well, that's not entirely true. The court does make law through the common law. The court doesn't make statutory law. But the common law is a sort of an incremental building upon cases by precedent. And the previous common law was contributory negligence. If you had any negligence, you couldn't recover. This was an evolving aspect of the common law and now found that we would have comparative fault. And so for about a year, we had what was called pure comparative fault. And you could have any percentage of fault, and that would reduce your recovery, but you wouldn't be barred from bringing a claim or succeeding. Mm-hmm. About a year after this decision, the legislature decided to get involved, and they passed a statute in 1984 called the Comparative Fault Statute under Iowa Chapter 668, and it provides that it precludes recovery by the plaintiff if the plaintiff is more than 50% at fault. So it allows people to bring a claim if there's some fault, but if they're more than 50% at fault, the jury can say no to their claim.
Okay, so if the person you're claiming against is only 30% at fault, then it's probably not going to happen, right?
No. It goes this way. Let's assume that go back to the car accident mm-hmm. example, and for whatever reason, someone says you have some fault, and the jury determines that you, as the plaintiff, have 30% fault,
right.
And the court, you're awarded $100,000, let's say, then your actual recovery is $70,000 because the recovery has been reduced by your fault. But if your fault was more than 50%, the verdict would be for the defendant.
Okay, very good. It sounds like we have just a few seconds left, but it sounds like this is fascinating, the way you say that the court doesn't make law, but through all these decisions, there does come to be a certain law there. Are these throughout Iowa's history hundreds of cases that make up this sort of law?
Absolutely right. And the common law actually comes to us from England and you know, dates all the way back to the Magna Carta. But it's this incremental building upon other cases. And the notion is of common law is that it would be unfair to treat similar facts differently on different occasions. And so the body of precedent is called the common law that builds upon incrementally as we go forward in the law.
Guy Cook, thank you for joining us again. Certified trial lawyer for Grief and Sidney in Des Moines. Guy, we'll have to have you back in. This is fascinating stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Glad to be here.
Guy Cook, president of the Iowa State Bar Association as well. Tune in tomorrow, Iowa Week here on River to River. The day after Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered in 1968, Jane Elliott, a teacher in the small Iowa town of Riceville, divided her third grade class into blue-eyed and brown-eyed groups and gave them a lesson in discrimination. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk with Jane Elliott and one of her students more than 40 years later about the impact of that classroom exercise. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Help from John Pemble in Des Moines. The executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you for joining us.